funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do people in Arab countries define themselves and their country's role in the broader world, and how much do authoritarian leaders care what regular people think, want, and need? My guest today started asking these questions at the time of the Gulf War, and his interest strengthened through the 1990s as Al Jazeera and later other satellite networks began to impact the way people in Arab states learned about current events within and beyond their own borders. Shibli Tilhami is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. His new book is called The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Shibli, welcome to Think.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So before there was polling on social and political issues in the Arab world, there were surveys of consumer opinions and behavior, the same kinds of things that a lot of us answer, seems like, every day. What were the advantages of piggybacking, essentially, on research that was already being carried out?
Well, you know, in places like Saudi Arabia, where people thought it's really hard to get people to talk about their political views, nonetheless, the Saudis had a lot of consumer polls, really dating back to the oil boom in the 1970s, when there was a lot of money, a lot of sellers who wanted to know what consumer tastes are. And so there was an industry, a polling industry, that was out there, and we didn't know whether, in fact, we can ask political questions. And when I started this project in the late 1990s, I was thinking more that we needed to get to know Arab public opinion, because it is important even in countries where you had authoritarian rulers. And we've seen that, historically back in the 1991 Iraq War, which got me thinking about this whole project, when you had the King of Jordan, who was an ally of the United States, go against the U.S. in the Iraq War because he was too worried that he would become illegitimate and would worry about his public opinion. Hmm. Whereas the Saudis seemingly went against an Arab public opinion that resisted the war and got away with it. So we needed to know whether, in fact, we understood public opinion. We were just speculating. So I found out that Zogby International initially was doing some consumer polling. I asked whether they can insert some political questions, a limited number, and not ones that would put the subjects in any difficult position. For example, I never asked them whether their rulers are popular or not. And we found out that we were able to get a lot of information that people were willing to give their opinions, and then we started a much more systematic method of getting at public opinion.
And it seems, Shibli, that there is a great deal of evidence that even authoritarian leaders who may or may not choose to sort of defer to public opinion, they are very interested in knowing what their people are thinking.
There is no question about it. And I think one of the big mistakes that was made early on in the analysis is that because authoritarian rulers obviously can repress the public opinion and sometimes even help shape it, therefore the assumption was public opinion isn't important. That was too big a leap to make. We found that, in fact, in an earlier book that I wrote about the Camp David negotiations between Egypt and Israel, then Prime Minister of Israel Menachem Begin complained to Anwar Sadat about him not accepting to make compromises, particularly in accepting Israeli settlements in the West Bank, and said to him, you say that you have to worry about your public opinion, but essentially you're a dictator. Why do you have to worry about your public opinion? Obviously, Sadat ultimately was assassinated, even without making the concessions that he was being asked to do. And in fact, he was so angry with Begin during those negotiations that they never actually negotiated directly. All the negotiations were through the U.S. mediators or lower aides, and they signed the agreement in the end. But it's always the case, and one of the reasons for it, and this is something that is complicated, particularly in the Arab world, is not just that it's obviously swimming with the tide versus swimming against the tide. It costs you more when the people are angry with you to maintain power. But it's bigger than that, because in the Arab world, you have people having multiple identities, mm-hmm. meaning just like actually most people around the world, but they're simultaneously Arab, they're Egyptian, they're Muslim or Christian, and they're all these things. And therefore, when they are judging their governments, they are judging the governments not only based on what it's providing to them as citizens, but it's also what it's doing on these other scores, being Arabs and Muslims, which bring in other people from the outside. Therefore, what happened, if you're an Egyptian, you care about what happens in Jordan or Syria or Palestine, and what your government does on those issues matter to you as well. So it makes it even more complicated for governments to assess what they should be doing to appease the public.
Does a religion-first identity make individual respondents any more likely to hold what we might consider to be extremist views than their neighbors who might put ethnic identity or nationality first?
This is really an interesting question, and I think it gets to one of the things that I've done throughout the decade. Just to give you a little perspective, I really was interested in the transformation of identity as much as I was interested in public opinion, mm-hmm. because that question that you just raised in some ways informs you about the prisms through which people hold opinions, because you're not just trying to get at what do people think today, but you're trying to get at what is it that they're thinking, you know, what is the framework of evaluation in the context of which they have this opinion. So that context of evaluation cannot be fully understood without understanding how they identify themselves. And that identity is changing. And so while people are simultaneously Arab, Muslim, or Christian, and Egyptian, Jordanian, or Moroccan, they do have priorities. And those priorities have shifted over time. So over the past decade, we have seen that the number of people who say they're Muslim first increased over the decade. The number of people who said they are Egyptian or Saudi or Jordanian first declined over time. So their affinity with the state has declined. Their Islamic slash Arab identity has increased. Transnational identity, what I call, has increased. And only a minority identify with the state. Now, what is the meaning of that? Is this really something that tells you about the rise of religion or the rise of extremism in the Middle East? No, because it's far more complicated than that. First, you know, the decline of the affinity with the state is in part, I think one can argue, a function of the failure of states to provide. After all, look at all of the uprisings that we're witnessing in the Arab world. But also in part, it has to do with the longevity of rulers. I mean, look at the Arab people who removed Gaddafi. The overwhelming majority of Libyans never knew any ruler other than Gaddafi. He had been in power since 1969, and the overwhelming majority of Libyans were born after that. And so when you're thinking, when they're thinking the state, what is Libya? They're thinking Gaddafi. When they were, when Egyptians were thinking, what is Egypt? They were thinking in part Mubarak. So it's very hard to differentiate between the state and the ruler. And if you don't like the ruler, you don't like the state. And it's kind of fascinating, by the way, that we've just now, as we're talking, we had a transfer of power just to occur in Qatar, which is unprecedented, where the ruler of Qatar, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, abdicated to his son only after 18 years, and he was only 61. It was a remarkable thing in the Arab world, but we rarely see something like that. Now, the rise of Islamic identity is itself interesting, and I think part of it is a function of the advent of the transnational media, particularly Al Jazeera. And the reason why that had an impact on identity is that by default, the consumer for the new media was no longer the local consumer, the Jordanian or the Qatari or the Saudi. It is now the Arab and mostly Muslim broadly. They're trying to reach to 350 million Arabs by virtue of a unified language. And therefore, they stress issues that appeal to that consumer, which is their Arab identity and Islamic identity. And in the process, they bolster that identity over time. And a second reason, particularly for the rise of Islamic identity, separate from the local reasons, that is, that Islamic groups were the only alternative to governments that were unpopular, is that you had, in some ways, a sense throughout the decade that Islam was under assault, particularly after 9/11. And people were rallying behind that part of identity. As someone once said, you are what you have to defend. And there is an aspect that is not really so much related to religion per se. It was more of saying, I don't have to apologize for being a Muslim. I don't have to apologize that Sharia law is the law of Islam. So it's an assertiveness of identity at a time when Islam was seen under assault.
Another thing that you discovered was that although a lot of Americans assume, you know, the phrase, they hate us for our freedom, that's not really the case at all. A lot of people in the Arab world may really strongly dislike U.S. policy, but that's different from hating American values or American culture.
Oh, there's no question about that at all. I think, and this we've seen throughout, and I'm, you know, mine weren't the only polls. In the past decade, there have been many excellent polls, including, you know, Pew and Gallup and PIPA and the Arab Barometer. Now we have a lot of good polls that pretty much indicate the same thing when you're looking at this issue of values versus policies. It was never the case that Arabs rejected freedom of democracy, and throughout the decade, when we looked at that issue, when you asked them to name countries that had most freedom and democracy for their people, all the countries they mentioned were Western countries, with no exception. Japan occasionally entered into the picture, but mostly the Western European countries and the United States. They understood what that's like. And when you asked them where they want their kids to study or where they want to live if they had to live outside their own countries, there's no question that the Western countries were attractive options for them. I think what was misunderstood on this issue is, number one, that they never really believed that the U.S. was trying to spread democracy and freedom in the Middle East. They never believed that. They didn't believe it, in the 1990s. They didn't believe it in 2000. And so they certainly didn't believe it after the Iraq War, during the Bush administration in particular. We polled on for the entire decade. Every single year when we asked, what do you think motivates American foreign policy, the overwhelming majority would say, help Israel and protect oil. And those who said advance democracy and freedom were generally less than 10%. So people didn't really believe that's what America was trying to do in its policy in the Middle East, even if they believed that America did well as a free democratic country for its own people. So that's one thing clearly that they separated in their minds in evaluating American foreign policy. But more directly, we asked them over the decade whether their views of the U.S. were based on American values, on American policies, such as, you know, toward Israel or Palestine or Iraq. And the overwhelming majority, you know, anywhere from 70 to 80% consistently said, it's policies, not values.
My guest is Shibli Telhami. He is Anwar Sadat, Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. His new book is called The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Shibley Telhami, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Shibley, you mentioned that the majority of people polled in Arab states said that the United States' primary interest is supporting Israel, or one of them. To what extent does the Israeli-Palestinian conflict drive identity in the Arab world beyond residency within the disputed territories?
You know, it's a central question because I think the whole role of the Israel-Palestine question is misunderstood, I think, in the Arab world. I'll start by saying, you know, it's obviously not the central problem facing the Middle East. It has nothing to do with the fact that you have poverty or lack of democracy in multiple Arab countries, or the reason you have internal conflict now in Egypt, or the tragedy that's taken place in Syria. So in that sense, it isn't the central problem facing the day-to-day life of Arabs. And Arabs don't wake up in the morning thinking Palestine or thinking I don't like America. Those right. are not the things that Arabs wake up thinking. However, what is misunderstood is that this issue, the Palestine-Israel question, is the prism, I call it the prism of pain, mm-hmm. through which Arabs view the outside world, particularly the United States, and the framework through which they evaluate their friends and enemies, their heroes and villains in the outside world. It's a shortcut to their identity because it represents it's a metaphor for all their experiences politically from the end of World War I, particularly their relationship with the Western world. And it is representative of a sense of humiliation that is persuasive. That is at the core of the drive for the uprisings. If you recall, you know, the uprisings were in the first place calling for dignity. Dignity was the one word mentioned most certainly. There was freedom and democracy and better economy. But it was represented by the chant after the overthrow of Mubarak and after the overthrow of Gaddafi, where raise your head high, raise your head, is a mesmerizing chant. I was part of one of these demonstrations after the revolution in Cairo's Tahrir Square, and it's quite extraordinary how it galvanized people raising their head high after this event. It was, in part, about raising their head high, not only as subjects of authoritarian vis-a-vis their rulers, but in the world. And I think no issue represented the collective sense of humiliation that people had in the Arab world than the issue of Palestine. And if you look at it historically, you know, you find that it's an open wound that is connected, particularly since 1948, that is immediate, that is ongoing, that reminds them of the grievances they have. And in part, the anger, of course, with the rulers is over repression and over the rulers not providing economically and not giving them jobs and not giving them better education. But it is also about the rulers not doing the right things on foreign policy, not doing the right things to raise their heads in the world, not getting the respect that they think they need, and much of that is connected with the issue of Palestine. So that's one reason, I think, why Palestine remains central. But then there is another reason, particularly for the U.S. When you are thinking about the U.S., if you look particularly over the past decade, there is a you know, a saying, Vice President Biden said it recently, members of Congress say it regularly, Israeli leaders say it regularly, which is that they should, quote, be no light between Israel and the U.S., that the rest of the world, and Arabs in particular, should know that there is no light between the U.S. and Israel, that it is one and the same. And in fact, you can argue that that policy succeeded, that over the past decade, in fact, Arabs see very little light between Israel and the U.S. And therefore, when they're angry with Israel, they're almost inevitably angry with the U.S. And so when we looked at the poll over the entire decade, and you ask people what is, you know, their source of anger and what the U.S. can do to reduce the Arab anger with the U.S., no issue is higher than the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Iraq War certainly was high in the middle during 2003, 2004, 2005. But even then, the Palestine question was very, very much up there.
You know, these are such brilliant observations and insights, Shibley, because I think they do really explain the disconnect that seems to baffle many Americans, you know, the question as to why there is this, you know, ongoing animosity. Would it surprise people, I don't know whether you've gotten to this question, in the Arab world to say, well, that's not necessarily the way the Americans perceive it. We don't necessarily see ourselves certainly as one and the same with Israel or you know, being unable to disagree with Israel on certain questions. And we certainly don't, I would think it's fair to say that Americans don't wake up in the morning thinking about how happy we are to have humiliated much of the Arab world throughout the history of the 20th century.
Right. And to be fair, obviously, the Arab problems are not principally America's doing.
I mean,
the U.S. has had a role, obviously, as a superpower and affected events in a big way, and it's visible. I mean, you can't ignore it, the U.S. military presence in the Gulf, the wars that the U.S. has been involved in, and obviously as a supporter of Israel. All of that is very evident. But I think that what happens, just as we in the United States ultimately form opinions both on narrow prisms, so do Arabs, obviously. And those prisms that we form, let's say after 9/11, for example, we call the 9/11 prism, where people viewed the Arab world and really even what was called the Muslim world, you know, 1.2 billion Muslims, through a relatively narrow prism of militant Islam and terrorism. And we've seen how that affected the views and the policies and the priorities and the budgeting and everything else. And, of course, that was a distortion, but it does happen. That became an American prism of pain of sorts. And, obviously, there is a parallel example on the other side. I think it's a dynamic relationship. If you believe that, quote, they hate us for our values, as the framing went, then obviously you're going to have very angry and feel hopeless about dealing with people who, quote, hate you for your values. There's no common ground. And on the Arab side, if you believe that America really is, in the end, out there to weaken Islam as an assault on Islam as a religion, or simply as an agent of Israel in advancing American interests, you just don't see any possibilities, particularly when there is no end to the Arab-Israeli conflict. So I think, obviously, these are distortions at some level that are based on reality. And that's why, by the way, in the book itself, I felt it necessary to, in addition to mapping out Arab public opinion over the decade, to also map out American public opinion, because I think it's American public opinion is fluid itself, and it's a function of events that are taking place in that relationship. So we have seen some beginning of a transformation from 9/11 to Tahrir Square. And so what I, you know, the question that I ask in the book is whether Americans begin to see Arabs and Muslims through a new prism of Tahrir Square, which is a different kind of prism. It's complicated. Maybe it's not as romantic as it was at the beginning, but it's much more human in its description and much more nuanced and much more complex than the one that emerged with 9/11. And in fact, there's evidence of that, of American public opinion transformation that has taken place.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Scott in Dallas. Hello, Scott.
You get to the question of they hating us for our values, and I think they do. And it's a question of, is it our stated values or the values that are shown through our example, our support of dictators And, you know, whether it's in Jordan or Bahrain, we never talk about Bahrain where they brutally suppress people, but Mubarak. But the Arab Spring showed us that all governments get their support from the consent of the governed, whether they're authoritarian or not.
What do you think, Shibley?
Well, I think there's no question that part of the dislike, no, about the framing, again, the hate is for our values. I don't think American values are to support dictators. Those are American policies. And I think part of what people disliked was, yes, American support for dictators, for sure. There is no question about that. It was in part that. But when you looked at their evaluation, they thought that these rulers were essentially doing America's bidding on the on issues that mattered most to them. For example, if you look at the decade preceding 9/11, preceding the Arab uprising, see, just from 9/11 to 2010. If you look at that decade, and see what really angered the Arab public most, what was really distinctive about their extra anger arising in 2010. You can't say it's some new severe economic crisis or some new form of repression. They've had many such food crises like the one they witnessed in Tunisia in prior decades. But the most distinctive part was really foreign policy issues over which their rulers couldn't do what the public wanted them to do. And even worse, they seem to be collaborating with the U.S. and Israel over policies that Arab public opinion thought went against their core interests and their identity. In particular, after the collapse of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in 2000, the bloodshed between Israelis and Palestinians that Arabs couldn't control or stop, followed by 9/11, the tragedy, and then the war on terrorism, but especially the Iraq war. You know, 90% of the Arab public opposed the Iraq war. The governments couldn't stop it, and even more, ultimately, cooperated with the U.S. over that war. And then the 2006 war between Israel and Lebanon, and then the 2008 war between Israel and Hezbollah. All of this, the people saw their governments as essentially agents of American foreign policy. And so in that sense, yes, there is a link that's related to foreign policy. Foreign policy wasn't at the core of the anger in the Arab world, in the sense that people wanted to get rid of ruthless dictators, but it was a symptom of that anger that was aggravated over a decade, where Arabs witness difficult and painful episodes over which they had no control and the rulers didn't represent them in any shape or form.
With regard to the United States, it's also important to recognize that people in the Arab world make a distinction between the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and the U.S. occupation of Iraq, whereas we in this country tend to say the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in one breath as if they are a monolithic entity.
That's a good point, by the way. I think not a lot of people comprehend that. I mean, let's start first with the circumstances of the intervention. I mean, I think we in the United States are fond of saying post-9/11 or post-9/11 American foreign policy or post-9/11 world reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, it's not a post-9/11. It's a post-Iraq war, because what we forget in this brief history is that right after 9/11, when the U.S. wanted to go after the Taliban in Afghanistan, it had enormous support and sympathy after 9/11. The U.S. assembled the largest international coalition ever with U.N. mandate, including got support from countries that normally didn't collaborate with the U.S. at all, that included Iran and Syria at that time, because people sort of understood this is a superpower who got attacked, and they had to do what they had to do. Public opinion may not have believed it, or they may have had a conspiracy about it, but it was a different circumstance. The Iraq war was an entirely different nature, because it was not through U.N. support, and they people didn't see any kind of justification, and they thought it went against their core values and core interests. So first of all, there is that circumstance that clearly creates a differentiation. But for Arabs, it's really interesting. Yes, they are both Arab and Muslim, and they do care about Muslim causes. They care about what happens in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Indonesia. But Arabs are really mostly focused on the Arab world. And we see that in the way they rank issues and their priorities, in large part because that one thing they share, language, is extremely important for the narrative, for their identification, for the affinity, for the level of comfort, for the interactions, for the visits, for the institutions. And so Iraq is an Arab state and Afghanistan is not, and that does matter in the thinking of Arabs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Roger in Flower Mound. Hi, Roger.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate you having this guest. This topic has interested me for a long time. But I think there's one thing we haven't spoken about yet, and that's history and culture here, which I think had a huge play in what your guest is talking about. And that history and culture is built around Arabs being part of an empire and not really having any say in, you know, and first of all, being at the tribal level, which is the basic level of their organization, of their society, and then on top of that, being part of an empire sans any countries or boundaries, but directed and not having any say in how their lives are lived or how they're governed. And it's only been since World War One. And the end of the empire stage of human history, that this has started to change. And you know, this is all they've ever known, is these dictators or these kingdoms. And, you know, how do you change that culture with all of these problems that exist? Because it's the culture that has to change first before you can get anywhere else.
Well, sit tight there, Roger. We will take this quick break and have Shibley give you his thoughts when we come back. My guest this hour is Shibley Telhami. His new book is called The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Shibley Telhami. He is Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. His new book is called The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. And Shibley, you'll remember before the break we heard from Roger, who had questions about the culture and the history of the Arab world, not until relatively recently being defined according to nation so much as tribe and cultural affiliation. Can you speak to those questions?
Yeah, I think it's a good question about the history particularly. I know about the culture because I'm not sure I understand the cultural part of it. But if you look back at the kind of the Arab grievances vis-a-vis political system, it was always true that many Arabs felt that the inception of the modern political system after World War One was unfair, and it was done in large part to benefit the good of the European colonial powers that won the war after the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire, and that they carved out the Middle East into a small fragmented pieces, particularly the oil-rich ones, in large part to continue to dominate by other means. And obviously they did stay through, you know, all the way through the 1960s in some cases in the Middle East. And since then, certainly since the 1991 Iraq War, the U.S. has been there in large part to protect those interests in the Gulf region. And so with it, throughout the entire period, particularly in 20th century, the battle was between different forms of identity. These states were new. In some cases, they didn't exist before. And these rulers, in some part, imported the monarchy in Jordan was brought from the Hejaz in Saudi Arabia to rule over a small country. And they had to establish their own sense of legitimacy, their own national identity. So it's been a battle throughout because they had to contend not only with Arab identity and with it pan-Arab movements, particularly in the 1950s and 60s, of people who wanted to unify the Arab world, such as Egyptian President Nasser, or the Islamists who wanted to create an Islamic ummah that didn't know the boundaries between states. But they also had to contend, yes, with tribes locally who may have differed in terms of how they wanted to be constituted politically. So that issue certainly has been with us since the end of World War I, but you can argue that by late 20th century, states had succeeded to a large extent in asserting themselves. And I think that in part the failure over the past 20 years, particularly, certainly since the end of the Cold War, has been glaring in large part because these states have failed to provide for their citizens and have failed to understand that while citizens were prepared to be loyal to the state, they never gave up on these other aspects of their identity, Arab and Muslim, and that they expected the state to go beyond just providing for the citizen. In fact, in one of the questions that we asked in the poll over the decade, we asked specifically, do you believe your government should do what's good for A, its citizens, or B, what's good for Arabs or Muslims? And we get half or more say what's good for Arabs and Muslim. That is fascinating because when you think about how we envision government to do what is good for the citizens. And here, people think that, yes, that's partly true, but it needs to do what's good for Arabs and Muslims even outside of my own boundaries. And I think states that have failed to understand that, or governments that have failed to understand that, have paid a price.
What do you learn by asking people in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or the UAE which foreign leader they most admire?
By the way, we asked that question without putting them in jeopardy vis-a-vis their own leader. So we say, whom do you admire most outside your own country? Mm-hmm. Which world leader do you admire outside your own country? And the story of the decade is fascinating because we started off with Jacques Chirac, followed by Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, followed by Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, followed by the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at this complex story, you ask yourself, wait a second now, how could this be possible? You know, what is going on here? These are complicated answers, given how diverse this group of people is.
So what do they have in common is what you want to know.
What do they have in common? And they all have one thing in common, and that is the fact that they were seen to have stood up to Israel, supported the Palestinians, and stood up to the Iraq War, to the U.S. on the Iraq War. Jacques Chirac is popular in 2003-2004 because he hosted Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat when he was dying and being isolated by the U.S. and Israel, and because he went against the U.S. at the U.N. on the Iraq War. And people rewarded him at the time, by the way, when we were talking about a clash of civilization, about this conflict between us and the Muslim world as being a clash of civilization. And here are people in the Arab world saying the man they admired most was a Western leader of a country that had colonial history, which is really quite remarkable. In 2006 and 2007, Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, a Shia Arab leader, recognized in Sunni countries like Egypt and Morocco and Jordan at a time when we were talking about the sectarianism that was emerging in Iraq between Sunnis and Shia. And again, he was rewarded for standing up to Israel in the 2006 war, and people admired him for that. And the same thing with Hugo Chavez. He appears in 2009 after the 2008-2009 Gaza war, and he was rewarded for being the only leader in the world to cut off diplomatic relations with Israel. That's why I say the prism through which they make the evaluation of the outside world is this prism of pain, this Arab-Israeli issue, because that was the open wound, and they make that decision particularly when there is fighting or conflict or bloodshed on that front, which is too frequently.
Interesting question here from Grace, who asks, do you see a unity in this prism of pain perspective among Arabs in the Middle East and those living in the U.S.?
That's an interesting question. I have to start by saying, demographically, there is a big difference between the Arabs living in the U.S. and Arabs living in the Middle East. Arabs in the Middle East are overwhelmingly Muslim. There are some significant Christian minorities in Egypt and certainly in Lebanon and Syria, Iraq, but they're very, very small overall, certainly less than 10%, probably across the board in the Arab world, less than 5% total. Arab Americans, the majority of Arab Americans are actually Christian. It has a long story. It had to do with the waves of immigration. It has to do with, obviously, cultural affinity that's easier, the history of immigration, particularly from Lebanon and Syria and Palestine to the United States. So the demographics really are different. But to the extent that there were polls here, and there are, like, the Arab American Institute has done polls among Arabs on this particular issue. I've done some polling among them as well, although that's not really part of the book. We've done that back in the early 1990s. There is no question that they rank this issue high in their priorities, that they too form some of their opinions on foreign policy and what they like and dislike about American foreign policy in part through this prism, not to the same extent that they do in the Arab world.
I understand completely that you are not doing this, but I wonder, is push polling to influence public opinion being used as a political tool in the Arab world these days?
Well, you know, of course, you know, it can't be, like, for example, if you're looking at the internet polling, it depends on what kind of internet polling people do. Let's take an example. I was looking at one of the Arab satellites. They have their own internet website. They call it a poll, but what they're really doing is they're asking readers, whoever wants to comment, and they get a lot of readers commenting. Sometimes 10,000 people respond, and they ask them questions like, do you think the Shia are to blame or the Sunni are to blame for the sectarian conflict in Lebanon or in Syria? I mean, that is, of course, a loaded question to start with, and particularly if you have a mostly Sunni, readership or viewership. And obviously, you're going to be able to come up with a headline and do that. Mm-hmm. And so you have to really be careful in the way, number one, you understand when people say a poll. What we've done is really hired firms. In the case of the Arab polls in the Arab world, we hired Zagabi International to do roughly 4,000 people in six countries, a sample that was chosen to be national representative demographically, and they were all face-to-face interviews, no phoning, all face-to-face interviews, no internet, because it was no confidence otherwise. And in Israel, we hired, because we do also polling in Israel, and I report on that, to compare Jewish public opinion and Arab public opinion, particularly on matters related to the conflict between them. We hired Dahaf Polling, which is one of the more respected firms on polling. And in the U.S., we've used knowledge networks for the polling among Americans. So we are very careful in crafting the questions. It's a big part of it to make sure that you're not biasing the answer So you have to be very careful with the methodology.
What use do you think American and other Western leaders could make of this information in order to guide foreign policy decisions for the region, at the same time attempting to win hearts and minds, or at least not lose hearts and minds with particular policy initiatives?
Well, let me start by saying, obviously, you know, when a president of the United States is making foreign policy, the first thing on his mind isn't public opinion,
right.
and it shouldn't be, you know, whether it's Arab public opinion, Muslim public opinion, for that matter, even American public opinion. There are some ways of thinking about the issues strategically, and at some point you have to do what you think is right. So it's not like one needs to have a policy quote that appeases public opinion, because you can't have a policy like that. But there is no way you can understand how you can carry out a policy without understanding how that policy is going to be received. If you, for example, really believe that the Bush administration was trying to push democracy in the Middle East, certainly people didn't believe him. And so if that really was your aim and you wanted them to believe him, you have to understand where they're coming from and what are the issues that define their judgment. I can also argue that, for example, now on the Israeli-Palestinian question, where the administration, the Obama administration, is trying to find a way to advance a peace between the two, even at a time when people are saying, well, maybe this is not a good time. They're not open to it. When you look at the polls, you understand part of the problem right now, which is it's not just an issue of getting back to the negotiations. So when we go to Israelis and Palestinians and ask them, are you prepared to accept the two-state solution based on the 67 borders, we have majorities on both sides say yes. If you ask them whether or not they believe it'll ever happen, majorities on both sides believe it will never happen. So what does that tell you? That tells you the question isn't getting back to the negotiations. It's a question of creating a possibility for people to transform their evaluation. If you believe that tomorrow you're going to face conflict, not peace, you'd be an idiot to make a concession today. And when you have that, then it frames everything else that you do. For example, we see incitement as a strategy to avoid peace. Yes, that's partly true. But it's also, if you believe that what you're going to have is conflict anyway, that it is coming, that is your evaluation, you don't want to give it up because it's an instrument to mobilize your public to fight an inevitable fight. And so, therefore, that information is important for the way you frame your strategy. If you want to really figure out a way to move forward on the Israel-Palestine question, you better find a way to change people's perceptions. That takes much more than returning to negotiations. It takes extraordinary effort.
Sorry, we have to jump in. Shibli Talhami's new book is called The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. Shibli, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. We had production assistance from Lindsay Connect, and Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.